With his forces rallied now, Preacher went about laying siege to Nova Roma. The palisades of pointed-tipped lodgepole pine saplings came down first, then the gaudy tents of the officers and the plain ones of the enlisted men. From the bastions, the defeated Roman legions looked on in numb disbelief. Given the distance between the camps and the city, they could retaliate against their primitive enemy only by hurling a few stones and large darts from ballistae and arbalists. The Preacher had even considered it safe enough to allow Terry Tucker to join him. With night coming on, destruction was completed. Fires were kindled, and the invaders enjoyed sumptuous hot meals from the supplies of the officers of the legions. At least, the demoralized legionnaires consoled themselves, there wouldn't be any more fighting this day. Early the next morning, their respite ended. Under cover of the most expert marksman among the mountain men, Preacher rode to the large southern gates and buried the last four sticks of blasting powder under one pivotal corner. He tamped it down firmly and wedged a big flat piece of limestone between the ground and the wooden portal. Then he lighted a fuse and swung atop Thunder to race away without a scratch.
Jesus Christ!
The Preacher was not done yet.
Let's go!
The small army rushed the gate. Boiling water poured down on the assault force until sharpshooters picked off the soldiers who dumped them. Rocks rained down, along with a shower of arrows and javelins. Nothing slowed down the assaulters. Mountain men swarmed through the opening and spread out in the streets. They left the legionnaires behind them for the Arapaho and Cheyenne to deal with. Those able warriors did so with grim efficiency. Far better trained since childhood, they kept three arrows in the air to each one fired by the Romans. Those arrows hit their targets, tumbling legionnaires from the walls in a continuous spill. In a swirl, the battle turned into house-to-house fighting as the legionnaires abandoned the exposed positions on the wall and rallied in small numbers to resist the invaders. Leading a dozen stalwarts, Preacher made for the half-finished Imperial Palace. From the forum, he had seen the distinctive figure of Marcus Quintus Americus disappear in that direction. Five well-armed soldiers held him at bay half a block from the front of the marble structure. Preacher and the others spread out and returned fire. Two of the guards died. Another one died hideously when he discharged an inadvertently triple-loaded rifle. That broke the nerves of the others. He rose from behind the low wall and ran toward the building.
I'm going around the back. Got a feeling that fella Quintus has got a lot of rabbit in him.
Preacher had the ride of it about Marcus Quintus Americus. While the legionnaires fought and died outside to buy him time, the first citizen of New Rome hastily stuffed large panniers full of gold bars and packed his clothes. His wife, Titania Fulcra, stood in one corner of the treasure room.
Why are you doing this, Marcus?
Shut up, woman, and help me!
Alexander Reardon, don't you dare speak to me like that!
Quintus paused with one ingot in his hand.
I don't believe this, Fulcra. You have always obeyed me. Please do so now.
It's all coming apart, isn't it? We are destroyed. I feel it in my heart.
Titania ran from the room. Taken aback, Quintus stared after her, then recovered.
Faustus, come in here! Quintus Faustus, come to your father!
Woefully lacking in training, the two guards at the rear of the palace fired at the same time. The Preacher quickly raised his Colt.
Want some company?
Buck Sears and Philadelphia Braddock grinned broadly as they approached.
Hell, why not?
Three men charged up the steps to the rear entrance of the palace. They found trouble the moment they entered the column-supported hallway. Three more gladius-waving soldiers waited for them. The fighting men of New Rome came at the invaders, their weapons poised for attack.
What is it with these fellas you don't bring the right tools to a gunfight?
It's just too damn easy with these idiots. I almost feel bad about it.
The hell you do! Come on!
The men started toward the central core of the building. A trembling messenger stood before Marcus Quintus Americus, his helmet tucked in the crook of his left arm, his face smeared with blood, dirt, and sweat.
General Varus and what was left of the cavalry have been surrounded and destroyed by the red savages. General Legat Longinus has fallen in street fighting near the Forum.
Is there any good news to tell me?
No, First Citizen. Well, I mean, we continue to fight, and the enemy is taking losses.
Only not so many as we, eh? Ugh. I am afraid the only advice I have is for you to find your way out of the palace and get as far from Nova Roma as you can, son.
Relieved not to have been summarily executed as the bearer of bad news, the young centurion nodded his agreement, saluted, and turned to make his departure. That was when Preacher Philadelphian Buck stormed into the room.
There you are, you goddamn snake in the grass!
Preacher's shot went wild, but sent the centurion with the First Citizen to the floor in an ungainly sprawl. The young officer had already learned that a gladius had little use against firearms. He hugged the marble floor, feigning death, until a boot toe dug painfully into his ribs. The young officer rolled over, intended to hack at a leg with the sword, only to find himself staring down the barrel of the oddest weapon he had ever seen.
Meskin's got a saying, feller. It's adios. No!
Preacher checked on his companions and found them otherwise occupied, each engaged in four guards who had rushed into the treasury room at the sound of the walk of Colt. Grinning now, Preacher turned to Marcus Quintus.
Looks like you're mine. Reckon that sort of fitting, you being the full elk of this place.
Quite fitting indeed. You really are Preacher, aren't you?
Yeah, that's what folks call me.
Then prepare to die.
I don't allow how it's going to be quite that way.
Quintus snatched up his gladius from the table where he had laid it and charged Preacher. The mountain man held his ground until the distance between them closed to 10 feet. Then he raised his arm and squeezed the trigger of his .44 Colt.
Whoa, shit!
Preacher jumped aside as Quintus made a mighty swing with his sword. Quintus came on, and Preacher nimbly jumped over a table, putting it between himself and the Roman tyrant.
That will not do you any good!
Sure it will!
It gave Preacher time to draw his tomahawk. Quintus lunged over the small table. Preacher batted the leaf-shaped blade of the gladius away with the iron head of his war axe.
A truly worthy opponent!
Quintus maneuvered to get past the barrier that kept him at a disadvantage. His left hand darted out and snatched up a bowl of pine nuts resting there. A spray of roasted pine nuts hit Preacher in the face. The momentary distraction gave Quintus time enough to leap onto the tabletop and execute a horizontal slash with his gladius. He cut through the buckskin shirt and opened a fairly deep line across Preacher's pectoral muscle. But Quintus had no time to savor his brief victory. Ignoring the pain and the accompanying weakness, Preacher swung his tomahawk. The keen edge bit into the flesh of Quintus's left shoulder. Roman staggered precariously close to the edge of the table. In the last moments, he righted himself and leaped to the larger counter where the gold reserves had rested earlier. Quintus slashed out with a gladius again. Preacher batted the gladius aside with the flat of the tomahawk and did a fast two-step shuffle forward. Quintus brought his arm up for an overhand stroke. Preacher aimed for the Roman's exposed knee. Quintus dropped to his good knee. With a kneecap split, his gladius became as useless as his other leg. He abandoned it for the double-edged dagger on the belt at his waist as Preacher came at him again. Bright steel flashed in the air, and Quintus made a cut on the right forearm of Preacher. Preacher was forced to drop his tomahawk as blood streamed from a severed vein. Only then did Quintus remember the small .50-caliber coach pistol he had concealed in the folds of his battle cloak. He reached forward eagerly.
Preacher, here!
Preacher caught the double-barreled pistol Philadelphia had tossed left-handed.
No! Oh!
Quintus's eyes went wide as they sought to capture some of the fading light in the room. His body would no longer obey his commands. Slowly, he sank down. Young Quintus Falcon dashed through the archway, a dagger held high.
He hurled himself at Preacher, intent on burying the slim blade in the man's heart. Suddenly, from nowhere, little Terry Tucker darted into the room at an oblique angle to Preacher and flung himself between the man and the Roman boy.
Look out, Preacher!
Terry's exposed chest took the full brunt of the blow aimed by Faustus. Somehow, Terry triggered a round from a small pistol he held. The ball blew the brains out of Quintus Faustus. Terry collapsed into the arms of the man he admired above all others.
I got him, Preacher.
Terry, boy, did not tell you to stay clear of the fighting. But to save my life, certain sure. Today you became a real man, one I'd be proud to call a friend. You go with God, Terry Tucker.
Terry must have heard Preacher, because a small smile froze on his peaceful face just before the end. Preacher allowed himself no further time to grieve for the boy who had saved him. He brushed a knuckle at the moisture that stole stealthily from one eye and came to his boots.
What now, Preacher?
I'd be obliged if you'd bind this arm in my chest, Philadelphia. And you, Buck, round up the rest. Tell them clean up this abomination. Pull down the buildings. Burn everything.
What about you, Preacher?
Me? I gotta go visit a little girl and her family. I got some hard news for them. News that's likely to swell them with pride and break their heart to pieces at the same time.
How are you so sure of that?
Because I reckon I know just how they feel, Buck. Adios.
The First Mountain Man 6, Preacher and the Mountain Caesar, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1995, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Terrence Hazelford, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, David Coyne, Colleen Delaney, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, Karen Carbone, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, Johann Detweiler, Dylan Lynch, Marianne Parker, James Konacek, Andy Clements, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Demery, Elliot Dash, and Michael John Casey. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Musical score composed and performed by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Preacher in the Mountain Caesar, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's Blood Bond and Eagles series, available from Graphic Audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening now for another episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator. It'll get you home.
Presents Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. Book number 2, Reefer Madness and More Tales of the Open Road by Ido Van Belkin. Copyright 2008, Ido Van Belkin. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode number 1, Thick as Thieves.
Rather than take another load from the Ontario Food Terminal, Mark decided he was in need of a break. In the past few months, he foiled a band of smugglers, was the target of an insurance scam, almost got ripped off for unnecessary repairs to his rig, solved a murder on a movie shoot, helped a friend get money from an unscrupulous shipper, was nearly killed taking over for Bud and working as a dispatcher, had nearly been run off the road by a road-raging fellow trucker, been detained by Canada Customs, and had solved a murder that had been made to look racially motivated. Instead of taking another load on, he decided to take a load off, of both his mind and body. He rented a parking spot at an operation near the airport and took a cab to Pearson International, where he booked himself on the first flight that was headed someplace warm. That warm place turned out to be Bermuda, and when he returned a week later, he felt refreshed and alive, and ready for anything the trucking business could throw at him. Mark called Bud while he was riding in the cab that was taking him from the airport back to Motherlode.
Hey, Dalton. That cell phone of yours has got some range.
I'm back in Toronto, Bud.
Already?
I went away for a week, just long enough to recharge my batteries.
Or deplete your bank account.
I could use a load.
You're out by the airport, right?
Yep, over by the park and fly.
Okay, when you get to your rig, head up to the Bacardi plant, Brampton.
The distillery?
Yeah, they got a load of booze that needs a special kind of driver.
You mean one that won't drink all the profits?
No, Dalton, you got any idea how much a trailer full of booze is worth?
Depends on who you are, I guess.
Dalton, we're talking a cool million or more, and it's no more difficult to steal than a truck full of widgets. So guess which load is high up on a thief's top 10 list.
So basically, I'll be driving a filet mignon through a soup kitchen.
Yeah, that's the gist of it.
Well, just wanted to be clear. But why me?
To paraphrase the sign that used to be in the Leafs dressing room in Maple Leaf Gardens, let's just say that theft does not rest lightly on these shoulders.
Mark was pretty sure Bud was giving him some kind of compliment, but he couldn't be 100%.
I'll call you when I got the load.
Me and a whole bunch of other people.
What do you mean?
You'll see.
The shipper at Bacardi was waiting for Mark, and didn't waste any time getting him to hook up his rig to the trailer that was sitting at the loading dock.
Here's your schedule.
The young shipping agent handed Mark a clipboard with a table on it that had times listed on the left at 15-minute intervals, and boxes where he could put a set of initials on the right.
You call the number on the top of the sheet every 15 minutes until you reach the distribution center in Winnipeg.
What if I have to pee?
If you miss a call, we check the global positioning satellite to find out where you are, and then we send the police.
Mark was a bit confused. This sounded like a military operation, not a load shipment.
Are you sure you've got the right guy for this load? I mean, don't I have to, be interviewed or write a test or something?
Your dispatcher helped us process all the papers for you. We were expecting you sometime next week, but since you were available today, we thought, why wait?
Mark stopped in his tracks. They were making it sound like he was the only driver out there.
I'm sure there are a lot of guys that could take this load.
The young shipping agent began walking towards the door to the shipping dock.
Don't worry about the cost of the calls. We're paying you a dollar for every call you make.
I'm really glad you chose me.
You got 5 minutes before you head out. Good luck.
Now, why would he say that?
Mark left the distillery at 10 a.m., just moments after confirming the time with the security guard at the gate. He turned right onto Steeles Avenue and was heading west. He planned on getting on the 410 at the off-ramp. As he pulled closer, he saw that there was a two-vehicle accident completely blocking the entrance to the ramp.
Oh, just my luck.
Mark turned Motherlode around. There was another entrance ramp to the 410 about 2 miles down the road. He glanced at his watch. There were a couple of minutes to go before he had to call in. Mark slowed Motherlode to a stop as a traffic light turned red.
Oh, you have got to be kidding.
Suddenly, Mark felt his cab door open up and turned to see a man in a ski mask climbing into his rig. Mark tried to push the man back onto the road. Before Mark could get the first man out of his truck, a second man had jumped into the passenger side door and was pulling Mark out from behind the steering wheel.
Let go of the damn wheel!
It all went down in under 30 seconds.
Oh.
The haze began to clear, and Mark realized that the first man in the mask was driving Motherlode. The second man had a pistol pressed hard against the back of his head. For a brief moment, Mark thought about taking on the two men. Mark doubted the driver would be able to control the rig while he punched and kicked at him, but there was the other man with a gun to consider, especially when the value of the load was more than enough for somebody to kill for. He decided to go along with the hijackers, for now. Besides, even if he did nothing, the global positioning satellite would kick in after he failed to make his scheduled call, and they'd probably be stopped by police before they even got onto the 401.
Turn left here.
In no time, they were heading south on First Gulf Boulevard, the continuation of Rutherford Road south of Steele's.
Here's good.
The driver pulled over, put on his hazard lights, then produced a pair of wire cutters from his jacket pocket. As the other held the gun to Mark's head, the driver exited the cab, and for the next minute, Mark could hear him crawling up onto the cab, most likely disconnecting the GPS transmitter.
Aw, damn.
Now nobody knows where you are.
The driver climbed back into the truck, and moments later, they were moving again. They continued down First Gulf, but before they reached Kennedy Road, the driver made a left onto Biscayne Crescent. They were making another turn when the man with the gun noticed Mark concentrating on the name written on a signpole to their right.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Enjoying the scenery.
Yeah, well, enjoy this!
The man struck Mark hard in the head with the butt of the pistol. Mark saw sparks behind his eyes for a moment, and then everything went black. Mark slipped into a dream. He was still married and still working as a private investigator. He'd been hired by a Fortune 500 CEO to get the dirt on his wife. The guy wanted a divorce, but knew it would cost him his fortune and then some to see it through. Mark worked the case for a month, then finally caught the woman fooling around with one of her husband's fellow board members. When the CEO saw the tape, he was so pleased to be able to get rid of his wife and business associate on the cheap. He cut Mark a check for $25,000 right there on the spot. Mark's wife's eyes nearly popped out of her head when she saw the check, and they spent a couple of weeks on the beach celebrating Mark's good fortune. Those days had been some of the happiest of Mark's life, especially watching the sun come up on the beach each morning. Mark was almost blinded by the light. He tried opening his eyes, but the light was too intense. He shielded his eyes and squinted to try and see.
Help! Somebody help!
Hey, you okay, pal?
Mark blinked, his eyes slowly beginning to adjust to the light. He looked at the man standing over him, the man who'd asked him the questions.
Where am I?
Let's hear it one more time, from the top.
Mark was exhausted. He told them his story at least a dozen times already, and since he was telling the truth, his story hadn't changed once over all that time.
My dispatcher told me to pick up a load from the Bacardi distillery. The shipper there gave me a schedule to call in every 15 minutes or so. I left the distillery and was going to get on the 410, but there was an accident on the ramp, so I decided to go south on Kennedy and get to the 410 at Derry Road.
There you go with that car accident again.
The detective was an older man, late 40s, early 50s. He'd told Mark his name earlier in the day, but Mark had forgotten it hours ago.
Yeah, and if there wasn't an accident, I would have gotten on the 410 and probably would have been in Winnipeg by now.
See, the problem is, we checked all the patrols from this morning, and no one remembers anything about an accident on the on-ramp.
So you think I made that up?
The detective just stared at him.
There was an accident, I swear it. They must have been in on it.
Who?
The people who had the accident. Maybe they staged the thing so I'd change my route, and the others could grab me before I reached Kennedy Road.
Mark was smiling now, proud of himself for putting that piece of the puzzle into place.
Yeah, maybe that's what happened. And maybe monkeys are gonna start flying out of my ass and singing Hail to the Chiefs. Come on!
The smile suddenly disappeared from Mark's face. The detective decided to change tact.
You got money problems, right?
Mark was caught off guard. He probably should have answered with the all-inclusive,
"Doesn't everybody?"
But the truth was, Mark was doing all right financially, since he hadn't had a lot of expenses apart from the upkeep of Motherlode. So instead of playing it safe...
"No. Actually, I'm all right for money."
"But trucks are expensive things to keep on the road. A lot of guys would do anything to hold on to their ride."
"Yeah, well, I own my rig outright."
This seemed to catch the detective by surprise.
"That's quite a feat, a young guy like you."
"Not when it's the only thing in the world that's yours."
"So, then what's your problem, Dalton? Booze? Drugs? Gambling, maybe?"
A smile broke across the detective's face.
"Women, right?"
Mark was also smiling again, but it was closer to a grimace than an expression of pride.
"I'm recently divorced. I've had my fill of women for a while. As for the other stuff, I wouldn't be able to drive if I was addicted to anything. And the only thing I've gambled with in the past few months has been my life."
"Yeah, seems there are police departments all across the country who know about you. Hell, even the customs people put in a good word."
Mark was confused. He'd been questioned like a suspect for the last few hours, and now the detective was telling him that police forces, not private individuals, but police forces, were vouching for him. And he was still stuck in this office under interrogation.
"Look, if you want to arrest me, then do it. If you want to hold me for a while, then put me in a cell, because I could use the rest. But if you've got nothing on me, I'd appreciate it if you let me be on my way."
"Don't you want to catch the guys that did this to you?"
"Of course I do. And who says I won't?"
"Yeah, somebody told me that about you. You like working on your own."
"That's right."
"How would you like to work on this with someone else?"
"Like who?"
"Like us."
"You mean like a sting or something?"
"Yeah, something like that."
"Oh, hell. Okay."
Two days later, Mark had himself another load of Bacardi spirits to deliver. Except this time, there were several key differences in the way he was to deliver the goods. First of all, he wouldn't be traveling to Winnipeg. This load was going from Brampton to the Liquor Control Board of Ontario Distribution Center on Enterprise Road in Malton. It wasn't much of a drive, little more than half an hour. But the last time Mark had been hijacked, it had happened less than a kilometer from the distillery. Secondly, there were only two pallets of empty Bacardi boxes in the back of the trailer Mark would be hauling. Hiding in behind the empty boxes would be six members of the Peel Regional Police Emergency Task Force, fully armed and ready to spring on any unsuspecting hijackers. And finally, rather than placing a call to a specific telephone number every 15 minutes to maintain contact, Mark would be continuously on the phone with the police in unmarked vehicles that would be traveling the route in front and behind him. With all these precautions and safety measures, Mark was sure the risk he was taking was minimal, and that if there were hijackers on the prowl today, the chances of catching them were excellent. Mark and the detectives went over the plan one last time.
"Why me?"
"You really want to know?"
"Yeah."
"Well, everything went so well for the thieves the first time they robbed you. They probably figure you're an easy mark. Your name on a shipping list probably sets off all kinds of bells and whistles. They probably think stealing from you is like taking candy from a baby."
"Nothing like bolstering a man's confidence before sending him into the field."
"Good luck."
"Thanks."
The police all hurried into their vehicles and Mark got behind the wheel of Motherlode. At exactly 10:30 a.m., he called Monahan on the phone and kept the line open while he drove.
"Leaving the yard."
"Right behind you."
A few minutes later, Mark was turning onto the on-ramp for the southbound lanes of Highway 410.
"No accident this time."
Mark headed south on the 410, then picked up the 401 heading east.
"See anything suspicious?"
There's a couple in front of me who looks to be having a wicked argument."
"That's not what I mean."
"Sorry, it's just that this ride is so, routine."
10 minutes later, he was exiting the 401 at Dixie Road. Mark turned north on Dixie, and the second street on his right was Enterprise Road.
"Almost there and not a bad guy in sight."
"Yeah, that's just great. Too bad you didn't have a trailer full of booze while you're at it."
Mark backed his trailer up to an empty loading dock. Mark hurried out of his truck and into the receiving area so the guys on the dock wouldn't get any surprises when they opened the back of Mark's trailer.
Here, let me get that.
Suit yourself, pal.
Swarm!
Within seconds of the door opening up, several gun barrels were pointed directly at Mark's skull.
Sorry, boys. Seems we've made it here without a hitch.
Mark was eager to try and make the sting work with another load, but for some reason, the police weren't all that interested.
This wasn't a task force operation, and we do have a few other criminals to catch, so...
You can't just leave it at that. These are million-dollar robberies. Armed robberies. Surely that warrants the full resources of the police department.
The detective showed Mark a smile that told him he thought he was being a wise ass. Mark decided to lighten up. Because whenever he started talking smart, especially to the police, was when he got into the most trouble.
We're gonna be keeping a close watch on the shipments coming out of the distillery and shipments out of a half dozen other yards in the city. But we can't afford the manpower to put on another sting like we did today. Now, we gotta get back to our regular work, and Bacardi has to get back to shipping their product.
I'd still like to take a few more loads for them.
Look, Dalton, this is a highly organized crime ring with employees, a distribution network, and all sorts of resources at their disposal. The last thing we want or need is some civilian who figures he's gonna bring the whole thing down by himself. You hear me?
I hear you, Detective.
Mark's eyes were on the floor, but they rose up slowly until he was looking the detective straight in the eye.
Now maybe you can hear me. I got ripped off for a very profitable load, and then I successfully delivered a truck full of police officers to a booze warehouse, a delivery that paid me nothing. As you pointed out on a previous occasion, I do have a truck that's expensive to run and a business to operate, so getting another load from the distillery would be an excellent way of making up for my lost time.
Yeah, well, since you put it that way, I suppose I could ask the shipper for a favor and get you a few more loads.
Mark was still angry and didn't appreciate the detective being so agreeable. He'd been all ready to have it out with the man, and now he had to be polite.
Yeah, well, thank you.
You know, just stay out of trouble, all right?
I don't go looking for it, you know. It just sort of finds me.
Mark wound up getting a load to Montreal that was scheduled to leave the distillery the next morning around 11. He got a room at the Comfort Inn on Clark Boulevard. There, as he lay back on the bed, his mind began to wander over the events of the day, and he eventually got to thinking about how the thieves had known to hijack him the first time, but leave him alone the second. It was as if someone had tipped off the thieves so they wouldn't bother with the second load. That meant it was either an inside job, or somebody was spending an awful lot of time watching the trucks being loaded. If someone knew what they were looking at, it wouldn't be too hard for them to figure out what had been loaded onto the trailer. So the thieves had probably known Mark had been involved with the police, maybe even knew there were police inside the trailer as well as in front and behind him on the road. But there would be no police trailing him tomorrow morning. He'd be all by himself again, a sitting duck for a group of knowledgeable thieves. Or maybe not. He'd promised Detective Monahan that he wouldn't try to catch the thieves by himself, and he absolutely had no intentions of trying it. That would be stupid. However, what was to stop him from, say, putting the word out and letting people know that he was willing to go into business with the thieves? It would be easier for them if they had a driver on their side, able to provide them with information on loads and maybe take a knock on the head every once in a while for a percentage of the load they'd be stealing from him. At over $1 million a load, even a 1% cut would be like winning the lottery. Then, when he'd been accepted by the thieves, he could give the police all the information they needed to break up the operation and put everyone involved behind bars for a long, long time. That was a good idea, and he knew just how to make it work. Mark started with the coffee shop of the Comfort Inn. Judging by the number of rigs parked in the hotel lot, the place was popular with truckers who wanted to spend the night somewhere other than their sleeper before taking on a load in the morning. Mark found a group of men sitting around a table, a couple of them wearing ball caps of transport companies, the others casually dressed in sweatsuits.
How you doing, fellas?
The men nodded.
You're looking at one lucky man.
Got me a load of booze in the morning going all the way to Montreal. There's some extra work that goes with the load. The pay is excellent. And it couldn't have come at a better time, too, if you know what I mean. I'm overdue a few payments on my rig, and my ex-wife's screaming at me how the kids need braces. And to top it all off, my mom needs to go into a home. You know what those places charge each month?
And on he went, spreading the word that there was an owner-operator who was pretty desperate for an infusion of cash. After visiting two more coffee shops and a nearby bar, giving the same performance at each place, Mark headed back to the Comfort Inn and waited.
Hello?
You Dalton?
Yeah, who's this?
Hear you're hurting for cash.
Isn't everyone?
Not drivers who play it smart.
I think I know what you mean.
You sound smart to me.
Thanks.
You got a load tomorrow, right?
That's right.
Now, a dumb shit driver would take that load straight to its destination and get his mileage, right?
Right.
But a smart driver, now he'd stop for coffee at a little mom and pop shop at the corner of Steelwell and Hedgedale.
I hear they serve good coffee there.
You are smart, aren't you?
I like to think so.
You park your rig as far from the coffee shop as you can and you stay inside for a second cup of coffee. When you get out, you check your load and then you call the cops.
That's it?
Earn yourself a quick 10 large, cash.
Sounds easy.
Easiest money you're ever gonna make in your life.
Mark thought back on his days as a private investigator and had to admit, 10,000 for having a cup of coffee beat the hell out of working for a living. But of course, he wouldn't be taking any money for his part in this. As soon as he got off the phone, he'd be getting in touch with Detective Monahan to tell him what was going on. Then, tomorrow, when he stopped for a coffee, there'd be cops all over the place just waiting for someone to rip off his trailer.
Oh, one more thing.
What's that?
You try anything funny, like, say, calling the cops. Just remember, we know where your parents live. Something goes wrong with the plan, then something goes wrong with them. You understand?
Mark felt his heart skip a beat.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Mark quickly called his parents.
Hello?
Hi, Mom.
Mark?
Yeah.
What's wrong?
Nothing. I just wanted to call and see how you and Dad were doing.
Well, his back's acting up, but other than that, we're fine. When are you coming to see us?
As soon as I can, Mom. I love you.
I love you too, honey.
What the hell do I do now?
The next morning, Mark picked up his load. Although he hadn't done anything wrong yet, he found it hard to look the shipper and everyone else on the dock in the eye. He'd gotten into this thing thinking he'd be able to get out whenever he wanted, but such things weren't up to him. When you're in, and it's almost impossible to get out. He'd laughed when Al Pacino said as much in The Godfather Part 3, but now he knew better. For the time being, Mark decided he would go along with the thieves' plan. Of course, he would be looking for an out the whole time, but there was no way on earth he was going to put his parents in any kind of jeopardy. Just thinking about it now made him feel sick to his stomach. As Mark exited the distillery, instead of turning west on Steeles, he turned east so he could make his scheduled stop at the coffee shop that was in the industrial area south of Steeles and west of Tompkin Road. Explaining to the police why he had taken such a detour from Highway 410 just for a cup of coffee would be a tough task. But Mark had always been able to think on his feet, and everyone said he could bullshit with the best of them. If all went well, his trailer would be ripped off and he'd make a report to the police. As long as he wasn't implicated in the robbery, $10,000 would be finding its way to him at some point in the future. He had no intention of keeping the money, and would likely give it to charity. Or maybe send his parents on a trip and give the rest to charity. And that would be the end of his career driving loads of booze and cigarettes. Mark turned right onto Tompkin, and then made a right at the first street, Steelwell Road. The coffee shop was on the corner of Steelwell and Hedgedale. It was called Truckastop, and Mark could almost picture the short, aged Italian man that would be working behind the counter inside. They'd told him to park as far away from the shop as possible, and in order to do that, he'd have to drive around the back of the building and park between the building and the fence on the other side of the lane. It was a perfect location for the thieves because the back of the trailer was completely hidden from view and any size truck could back up behind it without attracting much attention. Mark shut down Motherlode, got out, and made sure all the doors to the cab were locked behind him. All they needed was a greedy thief to start looking through his truck after the trailer had been cleaned out. Mark took forever to cross the parking lot and reach the coffee shop, dragging his feet every step of the way. As he neared the shop door, he could just hear the sound of another truck in the distance. It was likely already backed up to his trailer, and in less than an hour, he'd be hauling a trailer full of nothing. A short, middle-aged Italian man was behind the counter. He walked up to Mark.
What do you want?
A coffee, please.
Espresso? Or a dirty water?
Pardon me?
You want espresso or Canadian coffee?
Mark had never been in a place that called any kind of coffee Canadian.
Canadian, please.
The man poured out a large cup and Mark dropped a loonie on the counter. Mark glanced around the shop. There were middle-aged and elderly men smoking cigarettes and playing cards all over the place. There was a large-screen television high up on the wall in one corner of the room, and there were shelves of products, cookies and soda pop he'd never seen on sale at the A&P, lining two of the other walls. Mark didn't belong here. That was obvious. In fact, no trucker belonged here. This was a kind of social club for older men, or a place where young men who didn't collect regular paychecks conducted their business. Mark imagined what he would sound like talking to the police.
Well, I decided that since I was headed to Montreal, I thought I'd get a little European atmosphere at first. Sure, it's about 20 minutes out of the way, but I just had to have an espresso before I hit the 401.
One again?
Yeah, sure. Espresso this time.
The man smiled, as if Mark's order pleased him to no end. Mark glanced at his watch. He'd been here 20 minutes. He'd finish his espresso and head back to his truck. If he happened on the thieves while they were in the act, then so be it. Mark stirred two spoonfuls of sugar into the tiny cup and drank the coffee in a gulp. He left money on the counter, then headed back outside. It was still cold outside, or at least it felt like it, with the way the sweat down Mark's back seemed to turn to ice in the wind. Suddenly, a blue car was racing across the parking lot toward him.
The police!
His first thought upon realizing that he'd be busted was that his parents were going to pay for his mistake. Even though he hadn't tipped anyone off, the police were here now, and the thieves would probably blame him for it. He'd have to do his best to convince them otherwise. Mark began to run. When he reached the alley, he saw that the truck the thieves had loaded, a 24-foot international van body that had the name of some bakery on the side, had also been stopped by the cops. The cops had their guns drawn as the driver and his three helpers were slowly getting out of the cab. Mark ran toward them. A police car screeched to a halt in front of him. Two cops got out, the one on the passenger side first.
Stop right there!
Mark kept running but slowed his pace somewhat. The cop caught up to him, put a hand on him and tried to turn him around. Mark glanced over and made sure the driver and his friends were watching, then he threw a right cross that caught the cop square on the chin. The cop was dazed a moment, but then recovered. A second later, there were hands all over Mark, pushing him down onto the pavement and twisting his arms behind him.
Take it easy, pal, and you'll be all right.
After that, all Mark could think about was whether or not his little performance had been good enough to save his parents' lives. When they arrived at the police station, Mark still hadn't been placed under arrest, and he was beginning to wonder if he was ever going to be. Then he was brought into a room where Detective Monahan sat waiting for him.
Caught the bad guys.
Yeah, what the hell did you think you were doing?
I thought I'd go along with them, then call you to set something up.
So what happened?
They said they'd kill my parents if I talked to you.
You're worried about them, are you?
Mark nodded.
Well, your father's worried about you, too. Says he's gonna kick your ass the next time he sees you.
What?
Give us some credit, Dalton. We knew what you were doing.
You did?
Your dispatcher, Bud, called us and told us all about you. Told us not to be surprised if you went and did something stupid on your own. So instead of trying to stop you, we watched you around the clock. Damned if you didn't go and do just what Bud said you would.
But my parents...
Your parents are all right. And now that we've got everyone involved in the ring locked up, they'll be fine.
The detective's eyes narrowed.
You, on the other hand, are in a whole lot of trouble.
Are you gonna arrest me?
Maybe. See, my problem is, I don't know if I should arrest you or give you a citation. But that's not the trouble I'm talking about.
Then what's my problem?
Constable Bradley, the one you caught with your right hand, his shift ends in about 10 minutes. And he said he'd be dropping by to see you.
See me for what? If you won't be needing me for anything else, I think I'll be moving on now.
You're free to go.
Moments later, Mark was gone.
If you enjoyed this Mark Dalton adventure, be sure to check out next month's episode, featured on the following action-packed titles. Stony Man number 4, The Executioner number 322, Time Bomb, and Blood Bond number 10, The Hanging Road.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.